Excuse us while we get set up here. Yes, they're double A's. We have a couple charging over there. It might be okay, but let's keep. Keep those in reserve.
Okay. I'll just leave them with you.
All right. All right, welcome everyone. You could probably turn that down a little bit. I will go around and greet the people on Zoom, and then those of us in the Zendo will say hello. And let me see. Bob asked how many in the Zendo. Jim just left, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So that'd be 10. All right, I'll begin with Ingrid. Brian, Bruce, Bob, Marv, Yeshaitsoki, Paulette, Betty, Vin, Rosemary, Joseph, Lisa, Dave Q, Dave Brown, Lori, Christina, James, from Hawaii, right? he's on vacation there. Amelia, Henry, Mark, Sabrina, Pat, and Ruthanne. And in the Zendo, Alice, Rex. Katie? Dennis? Kazu? Gail? Leah? Linda? And Domio. All right. Welcome, everyone. In terms of announcements, we do have a one-day retreat on next Saturday. And you can participate part-time or full-time, in person or online. Very sweet way to make your day mindful. I would love to have people come to the Zendo. Chances are we'll make it masks optional. I guess I should make that announcement. We do have the results of our poll about masking at our Zendo. The board is still discussing things just because, you know, it's not just a matter of what we decide to do, but how do we decide if we need to go back to masking? How's, you know, what's the whole situation? So it takes a little while to make those calls. So stay tuned. We will send out an announcement and we'll change on the website if anything changes from what we're doing. But I think people have noted that especially for a longer day, if you're going to, you know, be sitting for many, many hours, that the results of the poll certainly seem to indicate that masks optional would be okay. So let's plan on that. And, I don't know. I guess I kind of left off halfway through the retreat thing, but check the website for the schedule. You're just welcome to drop in, especially if you are on Zoom. But it's kind of nice if you do intend to make some kind of plan to register and let us know what that intention is. Let's see, we've started precept study on Tuesday evenings. I don't know. Questions about anything that's going on or anything that I forgot to announce? All right. Sounds good. Then I thought first we might just want to take a few minutes to bear witness to the suffering in the world. particularly, of course, to the people of Ukraine, to the people of Europe, who are very, very close to all of this. For many people in Europe, it's like this happening just a couple states away, in American terms. Bearing witness to all the people and beings who have been suffering in war over the last 50 years, we might not have paid as much attention to as we do to this situation. May we open our hearts to the suffering in the world, neither avoiding it nor identifying with it, but allowing it to move through us, to awaken our compassion and humility, to soften us and make us ready to respond when we have the opportunity. May we bear witness to the suffering of other beings so they are not alone. And may we carry the awareness of them in a tender place in our hearts as we go about our daily lives. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. So today, my topic is Buddha nature. This is a huge topic in Buddhism. I could do probably an 8-week course on Buddha nature. So to sum it all up in one Dharma talk is a challenge, but in a way that's a good challenge. So the teaching of Buddha nature in original Buddhism, first of all, in context, comparison with original Buddhism, not that there's just one fixed thing that is, but relatively speaking, original Buddhism, as far as we can tell from the oldest texts, the suttas, and from lineages which have really aimed to stay true to that original form, which, you know, Theravada Buddhism is an example. Original Buddhism highly recommended the Buddhist practice and truth to anyone. But there was no guarantee you were going to achieve liberation. There was, you know, it was acknowledged that the path was challenging and that we all differ in our aptitude for it. So, you know, some people might achieve it quickly, some might take a long time, but in a sense it was okay, because all of this teaching took place within the belief that was of common in India at the time in which Buddhism arose, that we're reborn many, many times. So you don't achieve complete awakening in this life. It's like your practice will help condition your rebirth, and then you will continue to practice, so you won't like have to start over every lifetime, and that you'll progress toward awakening. Still, the original Buddhist view was something like, I'm not sure, you know, if this is an entirely accurate way to describe it, but that the human being is something like a tabula rasa, blank slate, at least originally, you know, in your first birth. In rebirth, the idea is that, you know, your birth is kind of conditioned by what came before. So in a way, you already start with some stuff, and we end up conditioned. We end up, if we are deluded, we can continue within that delusion. We can perpetuate that delusion. When we're deluded, we tend to be at the mercy of the three poisons of greed, hate, and delusion, or, you know, greed and hate. and our actions are influenced by them. And so practice is like deliberate choices we make, things we do, practices we do to counteract, you know, those forces of greed, hate, and delusion. So, you know, we've built up this karmic stuff and we need to purify it and work through it. And it's a long, gradual process. And once we're free enough of it, we're purified enough of it, then we can achieve liberation. So it's about human choice. It's very rational. It's just a matter of like, well, do you want to continue to suffer and, you know, be reborn and continue to be swayed by greed, hate, and delusion? Or would you like to work toward liberation? Just your choice. So in Mahayana Buddhism, which started arising maybe 500 years after the Buddha's death, there started to develop a new concept, Buddha nature. So in one of the very earliest texts to mention this, the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which what I read online today anyway, was probably written in Kashmir in the 3rd century CE. So this is a text that arose considerably later than the original Buddhist text. And it introduces two terms, apparently, Tathagata Garbha. So Tathagata is one who has gone beyond a Buddha. And then Garbha is womb. So Tathagata Garbha is womb of the Buddhas. And also the term Buddhata, or Buddha nature. And they seemed in this text to be used interchangeably. But there might be a subtle philosophical difference, I don't really know. So the sutra is really long and involves prolonged discussion between the Buddha and his disciples. I mean, there's some other things in there as well, but a lot of it is about the teaching of Buddha nature and what it means and what it doesn't mean and all of these exchanges. So I thought I'd share some of it with you. So the Buddha says, self, and this is self with a capital S, self means Tathagata Garbha, which then the translator says Buddha womb, Buddha embryo, Buddha nature. Any one of those, I guess. Every being has Buddha nature. This is the self, again with capital S. Such self has, from the very beginning, been under cover of innumerable defilements. That is why man cannot see it. Imagine that there is a poor woman. She has true gold concealed in her house, but none of the people in her house know of it. But there is a stranger who, through expediency, says to the poor woman, I shall employ you. You must now go and weed the land. The woman answers, I cannot do this now. If you let my son see where the gold is hidden, I will soon work for you. The man says, I know the way. I shall point it out to your son. The woman further says, nobody of my house, whether big or small, knows of this. How can you? The man says, I shall now make it clear. The woman says further, I desire to see, pray let me. The man digs out the gold that has lain hidden. The woman sees it, is gladdened, and begins to respect that person. The case is the same with the Buddha nature, which people have. Nobody can see it. This is analogous to the gold to which the poor woman possessed and yet could not see. I now let persons see the Buddha nature that they possess, which is overspread by defilements. This is analogous to the poor woman who cannot see the gold, even though she possesses it. The Tathagata now reveals to all beings the storehouse of enlightenment, which is the Buddha nature, as it is called. If all beings see this, they are gladdened and will take refuge in the Tathagata. The good expedient is the Tathagata, and the poor woman is all the innumerable beings. And the cask of true gold is the Buddha nature. So elsewhere, the Buddha says, all beings possess the Buddha nature. Only by observing the precepts can one see it. When one sees the Buddha nature, one attains unsurpassed enlightenment. So elsewhere in the sutra, he talks about other aspects of Buddha nature. He says, Buddha nature can't die or be destroyed. It is eternal and does not change. Buddha nature is true self, capital T, capital S. So Buddha Bodhisattva Kashyapa asks all kinds of questions. So it's an interesting dialogue. Well, if it's true self, but there is no self, right? There's everything is impermanent. So how could that be? And the Buddha explains how that can be. One of the things he does is warn, he says, a person may say, I have already attained unsurpassed enlightenment. Why? Because I have the Buddha nature. Any person possessing the Buddha nature has assuredly attained unsurpassed enlightenment. Consequently, I attain enlightenment. Then, the Buddha says, one should know such a person infringes the parajika. So a parajika is breaking one of the practice rules that requires like expulsion from the community. It's like the worst, you know, mistake you can make. So he says that basically that's a big mistake. Why so? There surely is the Buddha nature, but not yet having practiced the best expedient of the way, the person has not yet seen it. Having not yet seen it, there can be no attaining of unsurpassed enlightenment. On this account, the teaching of the Buddha is profound in its meaning and difficult to fathom. So why did this concept arise in Buddhism? I think it's because of the direct experience of early Buddhists, an experience to which I hope we all relate in some way, that a sense that which we are seeking is causing us to seek, that somehow there's a calling and a response, that if we didn't somehow have some kind of familiarity with or connection with the truth, with the Dharma, with enlightenment, that we wouldn't be, it wouldn't occur to us to seek it. And if a part of us wasn't already enlightened, how would we recognize the truth? How would we recognize, you know, skillfulness versus harm, you know, love versus hate, etc.? And the fact that the universe, as we wake up to it, the reality of it seems to include interdependence and morality in its very structure. And our practice just puts us more and more in accord with the way things are. It's not like this is a morally neutral world and we just decide to live in a particular way. We're responding to the way life really is. There's a sense of recognition, of coming home, of resonance, of belonging when we achieve insight or liberation. A sense that when we let go, when we are able to experience things free from the filter of self-concern, that we're manifesting a deeper self somehow, a more true, deeper part of ourselves is becoming manifest. A sense that all beings have some kind of kernel of good within them, no matter how, you know, how terrible their actions may be, that if we can get past their defenses, if when they're vulnerable and open, that there is some, you know, there's some good and there's some longing in there. Buddha nature is a very hopeful, positive, welcoming teaching. But it does open up potential pitfalls, as the prolonged discussion in the Mahayana or Mahaparinirvana Sutra makes obvious. If we have Buddha nature, why do we need to practice? Why is it buried so deeply? If Buddha nature is an eternal self nature, or is Buddha nature an eternal self nature, which Buddhist teachings have clearly established we don't have? If we have Buddha nature, why is it so easy to still do harmful things and to suffer? Why is it so hard to realize it? And this was one that was really important for me. If the Buddha nature, if you have it, but it's so extremely subtle and difficult to see, what good is it? Is it only good, you know, for us once we awaken to it? Great, now you've seen it. Now it's good. Is it of any benefit before? Because, you know, it feels like that's where we live the vast majority of our lives, right? Is not really being able to see it. So there are many analogies about Buddha nature in Buddhist literature, similar to that story about the woman and with the gold, which seek to illustrate that you should be joyful and encouraged to know that you do possess Buddha nature. You do have it. You have access to it. But it doesn't do you any good until you see it for yourself. So another story is from the Lotus Sutra, where there's two friends, and one, you know, visits the other, and in the middle of the night, one friend sews into the cloak of the visiting friend, he sews an incredibly valuable jewel, but he doesn't tell his friend about it. I don't know why. And the friend goes off wandering and runs into hard luck and, you know, lives in poverty and struggles for years and, you know, all the while with this valuable jewel in his cloak. And then he ends up wandering back to his friend, and his friend says, you know, all along you've had this. So again, that's like, you know, he didn't see it, so in the meantime, it did too many good. So as Jokin says in Fukan Zazengi, a text that we recite on Tuesdays, it is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to find it? So we have everything we need. And yet, if there is a hair's breadth deviation, it is like the gap between heaven and earth. So this was Dogen's koan. He was a Buddhist already, and then, you know, he was pondering this question: if we have Buddha nature, why do we have to practice so hard? So he actually made the long and dangerous journey all the way to China to find it. So he tells us, you know, it's useful to travel around to find it, but that's exactly what he did. So we'll talk a little bit more about this practice aspect, but that just seems to be the case. When we recognize it, we that's just part of your, that's part of your practice journey. So in a sense, maybe you do have to go on a journey to find it, even if it's something that you have already. So as for the nature of Buddha nature, this true self, is this some kind of eternal essence? Will your Buddha nature survive after your physical death? Well, no. Now, this isn't easy to understand, but not because we're stupid. Not because the concept is so incredibly complicated or vast. It's just that our minds are inherently dualistic. We think there's either a thing called Buddha nature, or there's not a thing called Buddha nature. Either way, it's a thing, and it exists, and it has thing qualities. Oh, excuse me, sorry. If, as the Buddha says, this thing is eternal and can't be destroyed, and you possess it, you must have a soul. So if we try to contemplate it and stay free from dualism, which basically, if we're using language, very tricky to do, you might think of Buddha nature as a quality shared by all of us. An orientation toward the truth, a recognition of what causes suffering and what does not, and an orientation to move away from suffering and toward happiness and peace, toward what is good. I like to think of it kind of like a seed when it germinates underground and it knows, it knows which way is up, it knows which way is toward the light. We have this quality of orienting toward the truth. So you undoubtedly have this quality as surely as any Buddha. So in this sense, using language, you could be said to possess it. But this possession is not exclusive. And your Buddha nature is no different than mine. You don't have a special Buddha nature. You don't have a special parcel of Buddha nature, and I have a little parcel over here, and you have a parcel over there. There is no division of Buddha nature. And at the same time, it's dualistic to start imagining there's some Buddha nature essence, like a big one essence that we're going to become a part of, which again, we're just thinking of a thing. It's just a really big boundless thing, but we're still conceiving it of as a thing. In what sense is Buddha nature our true self? This is a tricky one. As soon as we say self, we start thinking dualistically, because by definition, a self is a discrete entity separate from other selves and other things. It's a thing unto itself. But that's the thing. We are selves. As long as we're alive, we are. This lifetime, we're selves. And we manifest Buddha nature through the self, with the self. If there was no self in the small sense, there would be no Buddha nature. And if there wasn't a seed to move toward the light, there would be no whatever that's called, the tendency to move toward the light. Therefore, we have this question of the self and what it's all about. By saying our true self is Buddha nature, I think we're saying that this small self, this discrete self, is best used to manifest Buddha nature instead of dwelling on selfish concerns. So like our deeper calling, our deeper nature, our best use as this small self is to manifest this nature. And if we have Buddha nature, why is it so easy to suffer and do harmful things? I mean, and I guess this can be answered with the same story and analogy as to why we have to awaken to it and realize it in order to benefit from it. If you can imagine this, this man wandering in poverty and tough times, and the kind of the desperate actions he might be moved to take because of that perceived poverty. So There it is. When we're ignorant of our true nature, we're inclined to do selfish things. So why is it so hard to realize one's Buddha nature? So here's one of the sweetest lines about our true nature that I know of. So this is the Enmei Juku Kanangyo, the 10-phrase life-prolonging Canon Sutra. And it's the one that goes, we don't chant it here right now, but Kanzeon Namu Butsu Yo Butsu Uin Yo Butsu Uen Bu Po So En. So that's how we usually chant it when we do. And the translation of it is Kanzeon, salutation and devotion to Buddha. We are one with Buddha in cause and effect related to all Buddhas and to Dharma, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. So let us chant every morning Kanzeon with Nen, which is attention. Every evening Kanzeon with Nen. Nen, Nen arises from mind, and that's mind with a capital M, another way to refer to Buddha nature. Nen, Nen is not separate from mind. So our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. Wow, really? We can't believe it. That inability in a way to imagine this is our true nature is part of the obstacle, which is something that is portrayed in the Lotus Sutra, which I've talked about before. So there's like the parable of the lost son, who similarly, one of these stories, right? He is heir to a fortune. His father has become very successful, but he left home and has been wandering in misery and poverty and whatever, and he's kind of forgotten where he came from. And when he comes back home, the father recognizes him, but the son doesn't recognize where he is or his father. And he's very afraid, and he has a very low estimation of himself because of his experiences. So the father realizes he can't just say, "Oh, my son, come, you know, you're heir to a fortune." He has to slowly, like, you know, hire the son to do a menial job, and then promote him a little bit, and then get to know him, and then essentially through skillful means over many years, he raises his son's estimation of himself and his ability to carry himself in a different way, until finally then the father's able to say, you know, all of this is yours. So this is like this lesson that when we first encounter the Dharma, we first encounter this teaching, most of us are like, I don't know, it certainly doesn't apply to me. Or if it does, it's, you know, some unattainable thing. So in a way, this is a process of working on ourselves and healing ourselves, forgiving ourselves, accepting ourselves, and coming to the place where we can awaken to our Buddha nature. So the way to realization of our Buddha nature is through practice, but it's not a direct kind of thing. It's not a, all right, if you really want to awaken to this, you know, just next time you're in the cushion, sit really, really hard. It just doesn't work like that, unfortunately. Or fortunately, right? It's more organic than that, and we don't really know where and how this is going to open up to us. In a way, we just kind of cover all our bases, and we'll find out where something shifts. Interestingly, Zen Master Keizan in Zazen Yujinki, so this is another thing that we recite on Tuesdays, he says, Zazen is entering directly into the ocean of Buddha nature and manifesting the body of the Buddha. The pure and clear mind is actualized in the present moment. The original light shines everywhere. with something about our Zazen, entering into the ocean of Buddha nature. I like that, entering the ocean. We're just letting go into it, allowing ourselves to be supported by it, a boundless ocean pervading everything, not something that depends on us in a small sense. And just by entering this ocean, we manifest the body of the Buddha. And do you feel this sometimes? Whether on the cushion or off? When you drop that filter of self-concern? When you're fully alive and present in this moment, do you get at least an intuition of that ocean of Buddha nature? Of how all beings turn toward the light? So what about if Buddha nature is so extremely subtle and difficult to see? Is it doing us any good in the meantime before we have this, you know, I've found the jewel in my robe, I've found the gold in my house, I've awakened to my Buddha nature? I mean, it is what causes us to seek. And when we awaken to it, we recognize in what ways it's been intimate with us all along, that it has informed us and supported us all along. It's more like, oh, like that? Oh, yeah. So it is our companion, you know, that makes it a thing, but it is our companion all the way along, if you think about it. And before we awaken to it in a real, you know, visceral way ourselves, we just have to rely on that intuition we have that this is so, and then on faith. You know, that other aspects of this practice have been helpful, and it says we have this Buddha nature thing, so, you know, let me explore this. So all the way along, it is a good thing. And it goes way beyond the mere potential within each human being for spiritual liberation. So this was one of my koan questions that, you know, was really quite far along in practice when I was really wrestling with this. I'm like, okay, that's great. Buddhism is a path that can relieve some suffering and, you know, help you be a more moral person and live more at peace and all that. But like, you know, does every being, is the benefit just from someone practicing? Is it just like a path of practice that is beneficial, and therefore, like, the amount of benefit that Buddhism has in the world increases with the number of people who practice it, you know, and you kind of have to practice it in order for to taste this benefit, in order for Buddhism to be of benefit. So it's all dependent on our little efforts. And that made me really sad to think that's it. That basically we just have a really, really powerful self-help program here. But it goes beyond that. So I'm going to wrap up with some words from Zen Master Dogen, which I'm definitely not going to be able to explain fully here today. But just to give you a taste, because Dogen is wonderful for kind of amazingly using words to kind of blow your mind. Usually words are like, okay, you know, okay, I understand that. I'm not sure I understand that. All right. And then Dogen just kind of uses words until you're like, huh? And yet what he says sounds vaguely true, and you're not sure why. It's just a resonance. So I think of it sometimes more like poetry. It's evoking something in us, but defying our ability to just, you know, follow it in a really linear way. So he has a whole fascicle, whole chapter on Buddha nature. It's called Bu Sho. And I could spend many, many Dharma talks just on this. So he says, Shakyamuni Buddha said, living beings all are Buddha nature. The Tathagata is continuously abiding and not subject to change. So when I go like this, these are sections when Dogen was writing in vernacular Japanese, he would insert a Chinese character. And this is his way of essentially like italicizing. So when you read translations, a lot of times these are italicized, because he's meaning to emphasize this word. So know that the are of all our Buddha nature is beyond are and are not. All are the Buddha words, the Buddha tongue. They are the eyeball of Buddha ancestors and the nostrils of patch-robed monks. The words all are not limited to embryonic beings, original beings, inconceivable beings, or any other kind of beings. Furthermore, they do not mean causal beings or imaginary beings. All are free from mind, object, essence, or aspects. Venerable Ashvaghosha, the 12th ancestor, explained the ocean of Buddha nature to Kapimala, the 13th ancestor. He said, "Mountains, rivers, and the great earth all depend on it. Various samadhis and the six miraculous powers emerge from it. Thus, mountains, rivers, and the great earth are all the ocean of Buddha nature. All depend on it means that at the very moment when they depend on it, they are mountains, rivers, and the great earth. Know that the form of the ocean of Buddha nature is like this. It is not concerned with inside, outside, or in between. This being so, to see mountains and rivers is to see Buddha nature. To see Buddha nature is to see the fins of a donkey and the beak of a horse. To assume that Buddha nature exists only at the time of birth or life, and not at the time of death, is a result of the least learning and shallow understanding. At the moment of birth, there is Buddha nature, and there is beyond Buddha nature. At the moment of death, there is Buddha nature, and there is beyond Buddha nature." So anytime we try to describe something like Buddha nature, we risk concretizing the concept, limiting it, thinking dualistically. But when I contemplated for myself, if I try to describe it to myself, I like to think of Buddha nature as life itself. The tendency of matter from the Big Bang to organize itself into particles, and particles to form atoms, and atoms to form molecules, and then space dust and suns and planets. The tendency of molecules in the Earth's ocean to bind together and eventually become self-replicating cells, for life forms to evolve, for consciousness to evolve, for the tendency of sentient beings to contemplate spiritual matters, employ conscious choice, to uncover and share and practice the Dharma. I think of Buddha nature as being reflected in everything, in interdependence, in the fact that we can't harm other beings without also harming ourselves, in the fact that living selflessly is infinitely preferable to living selfishly. So I will leave it there for comments and questions. Hopefully this isn't one of those like topics that just so like, where do you begin? So don't be shy. Leah, would you come up and sit in this chair for the...
Sure.
Speak up a little bit.
So, yeah, okay, I won't be shy, so I'm thinking.
And maybe go ahead and take your mask off.
Does that mean... Oh, okay. Would it be synonymous to say that Buddha nature could be understood as the opposite of entropy? Or some kind of... Because I like what you said about Big Bang, because when I was thinking earlier in your talk about seedlings and how do tropisms work before, sorry, botanical term, but anyway, how do tropisms work underground before the sun is perceivable?
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, maybe it's light or maybe it's sun, because I'm trying to, you know, conceptualize what you're saying. I don't know what the word for opposite of entropy is, but maybe, I don't know. I'm trying to get to it.
That's kind of inspiring. I guess what raises a red flag is the idea that it could have an opposite, because then we've kind of concretized it too much. You know, so in a way, like, my little, like, imagining, well, it's kind of like life itself and the way that, you know, space dust, you know, that doesn't really, it falls short of the real mark.
Sure, because they're words.
yeah, right. but I kind of like, I hadn't thought about that other aspect of it.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Anyway.
Mark.
I read once, and don't ask me where, some ancient master describing the nature as completely empty and wondrously self-illuminating. And I like that. I get a lot of mileage out of it, but I have a tendency to think that the self-illuminating part is plain old human consciousness. And your talk today makes me wonder if self-illuminating isn't simply this tendency for that which we seek to be the reason we seek, or we are seeking on account of that which we seek. Is that the self-illuminating quality?
It is surprising that, you know, an experience of Buddha nature or the absolute or whatever is ends up for most of us having a luminous quality, because it seems like, well, it's empty, you know, what makes it, I don't know, and maybe that's part of it, part of the fact that, like, what I guess I expected when I got there it would just be a nihilistic void or something. And the fact that it's luminous instead, to me, is Buddha nature's one word for it, the absolute's another word for it, that, wow, this is the nature of the universe. So I don't know, self-illuminating is like, it's not like the self is responsible for the illumination. Something else you said, though. Oh. Oh, I don't know. No, I forgot. There was something else I wanted to say in response, but thanks. Dave.
As you were talking, I was thinking of quantum physics, just as you mentioned, but I was also thinking of Taoism. It almost feels like a nature that's there that you can experience, but as soon as you try and analyze it or grasp it, it goes away. So it's almost like that Taoist nature, why trees move and grow and but if you try and analyze it, you've lost it. Is that kind of right? Or am I off track there?
Well, I've been too busy to delve into a book that's been sitting on my shelf for a while now that I just wish I had, you know, infinite time. And it argues that Chan has as much Taoism is in it as Buddhism. So, like, I'm not saying that like I'm an expert and that is the case, but that's what this book argues, and what I've read of it so far, it's very fascinating and interesting, and kind of rings true in the sense that when you look at original Buddhism, I mean, like, where did this whole Buddha nature thing come from? And this sense, this, it does seem like this is a unique, you know, when Buddhism got to China, this addition that, like, this sense that there is a way, there is something we are part of, which is bigger, and that we can align ourselves with and flow with, that is not a nihilistic void, and it has certain principles. And so practice is about aligning ourselves with that, as opposed to this Indian view, which is like, we want to purify ourselves so we can get the heck off of this cycle of life. It's very, very different. I think you're onto something there. Brian.
I think this is the sort of topic where you don't have to feel bad about saying something kind of silly. So at least that's what I'm going to go with. And when I boil this sort of thing down, it gets to like, well, we have seen in ourselves and in the world really deeply beautiful, inspiring, extraordinary things. We've also seen a lot of gunk, and we've also been a lot of gunk. When you talk about this, it feels like a kind of relationship, right? I mean, you can get closer to it. You can, you know, see it, glimpse it, sort of be it, but it is a relationship between what you're doing and, I don't know, you know, something else, you know, it arises, you know, because of, I don't know, what you sort of do, what you're prepared to do, what you feel, what you have faith you can see and do, what you vow to do. Anyway, it's just, anyway, so that's the end of the silly. But this is a very wonderful topic. I really, very grateful that you raised it. So.
Yeah. I mean, I just really, you know, that refrain, I think of it, that from the Kanzan chant, our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. That for me, that comes out of my teacher's mouth. I mean, obviously she didn't make it up, but she's the one who would, you know, come back to that and remind me of that. And, you know, that just that exploration, I mean, what makes us even want our true nature to be eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure? You know, it's like, that's where that sense that when we, as we get close to it, it's like, it's this sense of returning, of becoming who we're meant to be, of moving closer to our heart's deepest longing. So, like, you know, before we've found our jewel or our gold, we're like, I really want to be eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. I mean, joyous is such a sweet aspect of that. Alice.
So when I was a high school student learning physics, I asked my teacher something that he couldn't understand what I was asking about. I asked him, we were learning about matter and atoms and entropy and all that stuff. And then I said, Mr. Windsor, what is a flame? And he was like, well, a flame is a flame. And I said, yeah, but what is it? Like there's rocks and atoms and, you know, electrons. Well, what is a flame? And he's like, well, a flame is a flame. And I said, no, but I can see it's got color. There's blue flames and orange flames. And there's clearly a flame there, but I can't touch it. I can't feel it. There's no matter there, right? And he says, no, there's no matter. So how can you say a flame exists? And that's kind of how I see this little Buddha nature thing, which is that it's a flame that you can't quite touch or grasp or get a hold of, but you know it exists. And that also I could feel other people's flames because they're warm. And, you know, it's like if someone practiced with their flame, then you have no choice but to also feel the warmth around the room, regardless of whether you're enlightened or not, or whatever. That's all.
Thank you. Yep. Were folks online able to hear that okay? Oh, good. We're testing a new setting on the microphone, so who
knows? I thought that was brilliant. I'm going to be thinking about the flame all day. It bowled me over.
We've got a minute. James.
Thank you. I appreciate Alice saying that flames, I contemplate my candle sometimes when I'm doing Zazen and just, where does it come from? It's kind of a nice practice. So thank you for that, Alice. The one thing that this whole topic of Buddha nature, the one thing that has always helped me feel like I'm getting lost close sound, to it is James. That. Oh, okay. How's that? Is that better?
Uh-huh.
You hear me? Okay. One thing that's helped me a lot is the Dogen phrase that I'm not going to get it exactly right, but to carry the self forward to the myriad things is delusion, to allow the myriad things to come forward and eliminate the self is enlightenment or something along those lines. And that really helps me to feel like, oh, you know, there's getting close to Buddha nature. It's probably that stepping back from and just letting, you know, as opposed to doing, you know, letting the things, just letting life be and letting time be what it is and really blending into the background in a way. I know that's, I'm not really verbalizing correctly my feeling on that, but it probably can't. That's probably part of the point. But that phrase has helped me a lot with my kind of trying to conceptualize, which is also wrong, this concept of Buddha nature. So thank you.
Yeah, it, I think, we're at 12:15, so I'll wrap it up, but I'm gonna just leave you with a image. So I know that when I was briefly a Christian, I went to Catholic school, and I heard that Jesus loved me, just no matter what. And there was part of me that thought, like, well, what good is that? If it's not like an individual love, if it has nothing to do with you know, who I am or what I've done or anything, and that he loves you just as much as he loves me, like, okay. It didn't strike me as being very, you know, because if you're so focused on the self, basically a love that has nothing to do with yourself, it doesn't serve the self's needs. But then later, this sense of Buddha nature, this sense of belonging, I broke more into like a sense of grace, if you will, and recognized how sweet it was to accept this grace, this benefit, and have it really have, you know, like, it's unconditional. There's nothing I can do to not have this grace and this belonging. And it was really a letting go of self. So really, this is why Dogen says to, you know, we study the self. We study it in order to be able to let go of it, in order to be able to see beyond it, and that it is about the self, but it's not about the self. So, you know, I had this vision that I was one luminous leaf on a big luminous tree, maple tree, and that, you know, all of the leaves were bright and luminous, and, you know, I was beautiful and I belonged. I had Buddha nature and so did you. And like, so it was that kind of wedding of individuality and this belonging to something greater that was very redemptive. That was a very, very pivotal moment for me in my growing relationship with Buddha nature. So I will give our closing verse. I'm sorry, Bob, to miss you. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita. You all for coming. Have a good day.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
I have a question for Bob and Mark.
Thank you.
That's Bob the Art Kempter, our recorder.